Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page. You can't sign up for the Here We Still Stand National Conference next year. It's already sold out. You can sign up and get on the wait list, though, which is worth doing, because when people register for an event a year out, you know, things come up. People move, you know, stuff happens. And some people did, in fact, sign the wait list last year and ended up getting in. And so it's first come, first serve, of course. So if you want to get on that wait list, you can. Or, of course, you can come to Northwest Arkansas the first weekend of May, and you can go to the regional event. There's still, 25% left of the tickets. So those won't be there that long. So if you want to come to that, there's a link in the show notes, or go to the events page. Find it and come hang out with me and Chad and a whole bunch of other people. It's going to be a good time. Chad, the weather has officially changed here. So, like, my voice, I'm not sick. Don't worry, guys. I'm okay. I know that you guys were all starting to pray. Don't worry. I'm all right. But every fall, you know, I got like a week or two where my voice just gets, you know, it tries to match Chad. It just drops a couple octaves, a little scratchy, a little low, but it's okay. I can make it through. I feel fine. All right. We are in Job chapter 6. We've heard from Job. Then we've heard from his buddy who, he says a lot of words. If I was to boil it all down, come on, Job. Come on. What is it, dude? That's really what like is going on with his buddy. That's what I was, if I boil it all down to one thing, he could have just said after Job's big thing, come on, man, we're holding back. What are you not telling us? And now Job is going to respond sort of to what Eliphaz says. And I do like this. I don't usually like chapter headings, but this seems like a good summation of what Job's going to say. In the ESV, it just says, my complaint is just. I think that's a pretty good summation of what Job is about to say in response. Because I do think, as he says, come on, man. Come on, buddy. Like, what is it? Like, you are not telling everything here. This is basically what Job is going to say. He's like, no. Everything I said, I am justified in saying.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to my complaint is just is preface it by, you guys are terrible friends.
Yeah.
That'd be the only thing that I would add. His next speech, Job's next speech is chapter 6 and 7. And he's going to start out by complaining about how he's become basically the target for the archer from heaven. Like, God's got his bow out and he's using Job for target practice with poison arrow tips, you know, just to kind of add a little bit to that. So he's going to complain at first, and, you know, rightly so. I'm not taking anything away from that. But then he's going to go on to complain about his buddies and, you know, what terrible friends they are. He's actually going to throw some pretty sharp accusations at them. Anyway, then he's going to switch, and he's going to transition to talking directly to God. And the bulk of chapter 7 sounds a whole lot like, what was that, Job 4? Or Job 3, where he basically wishes he were dead. So he's going to kind of return to this same theme of just how bad his sufferings are.
Yeah, I mean, if you are Job, man, if I was Job and this was happening to me, I think there would be two things that I would be. You know, these are the two words that would describe me. Angry and confused. Like, I would be, especially once my friends came around and started being like, what gives, man? What's going on? It would be so frustrating if because maybe not for you and me, Chad, because we're not, you know, no one would describe it. Job is a unique character that can be described in a very unique way. So maybe I'd be like, what did I do? And then, like, there's probably any number of things, you know, that I'd come
be
up
like
with.
A long list. I'd be like weighing. Like, I don't know. Was that one worse than this one? I don't know. They're pretty close. They're both pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It'd be one of those things where I don't know if someone's like, man, did you do anything? I'd be like, well, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know where to start.
Yeah. But Joe,
which particular one God has decided he's going to use as a pretext for what he's doing to me.
Yeah, but Job, you know, he's in this situation like, I don't know, man. Like, I can't think of anything.
Got a pretty clean bill of health. Yeah. So he starts out by talking about, it's kind of a twofold focus. He says, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed and all my calamity laid in the balances." So it's kind of a twofold focus. I mean, he's vexed. He's angry, like you just said, you know. So what in the world is going on? If you could weigh my vexation, how angry and upset and vexed I am at this situation, then you're gonna need like an industrial size scale. That's how heavy it is. And then my calamity. So that could also be translated like destruction or misfortune. So laid in the balances. So, you know, if you had some kind of scales where you could put both my vexation and my calamity, my anger and my misfortune on there, well, then you'd get an idea as to exactly what I'm going through. So and presumably this first part is just kind of addressed either to Eliphaz in particular, who just responded to Job, or just to the friends in general. I don't think he's necessarily praying yet or talking directly or indirectly to God. Yeah, I guess he's always talking indirectly to God, but this is more friend-directed. So if you could do that, then verse 3 says, it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. So yeah, a typical kind of proverbial biblical expression. We're used to thinking about sand of the sea in respect of numbers, not weight. Like Abraham's descendants will be like the stars in the heavens or like the sand on the seashore. But Job uses it differently here. So yeah, go to the beach and just start shoveling up sand after sand and get a whole truck full and weigh that. Well, the weight of that wouldn't even compare to the vexation and calamity that Job is going through.
Yeah.
Words have been rash.
Yeah. Well, vexation is an interesting word. We don't use that word a lot. Not many times have I, you know, have Chad and I been hanging out. And I'm like, how you doing? You're like, well, I'm pretty vexed. I got to tell you.
Traffic just had me vexed today.
My vexation is high this week. That's not a word we use, but it is. I like the word because it's a word that, you know, he could just say, like, my frustration, which is kind of really what vexation is. Like, vexation is a sort of frustration. But if it just said frustration, it would not do the same thing. Because vexation is, like, more painful than just being frustrated, right? Like, if you're vexed, of course, being frustrated is an internal thing. But there's a... it's a frustration mixed with sorrow, almost. That's how, when I hear the word vexation, it's like there's people aren't vexed when they're just angry because they feel, you know, like whatever, because they're upset about something. It's usually when you see the word vexation show up, some calamity has happened. I mean, and this is kind of why he says my calamity is weighing the balance. So, I mean, that's a total aside, but I like the use of the word there. And that vexation could be weighed, right? Like if it said, like, my frustration were weighed or my anger would be weighed, you're like, okay, so you're angry and frustrated. You're like, yeah, but it's like, it's more than that. Like, this is like some real internal anguish and frustration.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, you get to anger, sorrow, frustration. You put those three together, you get vexation.
Yeah.
And by the way, fun fact, Job's book is the only one that has this Hebrew word in it, which actually kind of makes sense. I mean, there is no greater vexation in the Old Testament than that suffered by Job. So all the occurrences of this word are found in Job. So he says, because of this, because of the vexation, the calamity, the bulk of it, the weight of it, yeah, my words have been rash. And he's not saying, usually when we say my words have been rash, we're like apologizing. Sorry about those rash words. He's not apologizing. He's just explaining that, yeah, of course. I would expect me to just to be very kind of staid and calm and level-headed. Well, no, not when I have this tonnage of vexation and calamity weighing upon me. Of course, my words are going to be rash. And we've been the one who's have spoken this way, and we've been in the presence of people who have spoken this way, because they're so emotionally distraught. The words that come out of their mouth are probably not the kind of words you would ordinarily hear from them.
Yeah.
You know, they're very upset. And so when we're very upset, of course we speak rash words. And I mean, it's not like making an excuse for it, but when you're in those situations, you understand where the person's coming from. And so your response should be patience and understanding and empathy and just kind of, you know, bearing with them and the pain that they're going through. Of course, that's not what his friends are doing. They're trying to unearth his hidden sin, whatever that might be.
Yeah. If you were to say that your words are rash, usually you mean that you did not choose them carefully, right? Where you're like, oh, I didn't really, I said that not, without thinking about it really. Or usually like like rash words are words that you, if you could take them back and maybe rephrase them or think about them a little more, you would do that. However, Job did wait 7 days before he spoke these rash words. So he did have a lot of time to sort of figure out what it was he's going to say. But I think when you're in this state of vexation and anguish, once you open your mouth to speak, like, I mean, read what Job says. I mean, it's a flood. The flood is unleashed. The dam has broke. And I think I've been in that. Of course, we've been in situations where we've spoken too quickly. And you're like, oh, I was upset and I said
shouldn't
that.
Said that.
I shouldn't have said right. that. But there's also been times, I don't know about you, Chad, but I've had these times where I have had time just to really think about my words and really concoct a real tongue lashing. Not that I'm like I'm not the wordsmith that Chad is. I'm like fairly good with words when I have a lot of time to think about them. Not like this on the podcast, but like, you know, I've written some things. That's not always the best either. Sometimes when I have a lot of time to think about my words, just because Job has lots of times to choose his words. Also, when those words start flowing, yeah, maybe you get bumped off script a little bit too. And so, yeah, I don't view this as an apology at all, but more like, yeah, man, like, have you look around, dude. And then you're saying like, I don't know about your words, Job. You don't know about my words. Take a look around, dude. Look at what's happening right now. Like, what did you think my words were going to sound like?
Yeah, there is no other possibility for Job when he's going through what he's going through. I mean, the only thing that's finally going to take away his words is when God words him.
Yeah.
Right? When God speaks, finally, then Job is ready to be silent, but he's not there yet. So he then develops this figure of speech and in the next two or three verses and begins to describe his suffering and why he speaks the way he does, why he can't remain silent. And the first thing he begins with is the divine archer. The arrows of the Almighty are in me, and my spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. And that's just one verse. And that one verse sums up, sounds to me like hell on earth. Just the image. I mean, we've all seen these pictures like of martyrs. I can't remember the name of the martyr. There's one pic of the martyr who was shot full of arrows.
Yeah.
But I mean, we've seen pictures from the Wild West, right? Of guys lying in the dirt and their bodies are full of arrows. That's the way it works. That's Job is saying, hey, that's how I feel. God has set me up as his target. He's got his bow, got a quiver full of arrows, and the tips are poisoned, and he shoots one after the other inside me, and my spirit is drinking in the poison of these arrows. So as if the arrows that piercing aren't bad enough, then you have this internal poisoning taking place at the same time. And then he, you know, describes these terrors of God that are arrayed against me. That word, by the way, only occurs here and in Psalm 88, which, if you know Psalm 88, it's the darkest of the Psalms. So your wrath has swept over me. Your dreadful terrors destroy me, the psalmist says in Psalm 88. Psalm 88 is a very Job-like psalm, for those of you who don't know it. So anyway, that's kind of where he's at. He's a target for God's arrows, and he's got these divine terrors that are stacked up against him like an army.
Yeah, this is weird because he's wrong, but not wrong. So like he's not wrong necessarily in what he's saying, but he is also wrong. So
factually in error.
Well, I just think this is the thing that's fascinating about Job is that if you were really going through something, right, Chad, something terrible happened to you, and then I came along and I was like, hey man, what's going on? And then you were like, oh, well, what it is God's really got it out for me, and he's shot my body up full of poison arrows, and he's tormenting me. I would be like, nope, that's not it. Your theology has gone awry, my friend. That is not what's happening. And we know, because we have like this sort of view into what is actually happening, that of course it is the accuser, the Satan, that is doing all this. But again, and you see, and we've talked about this before, but since it's so explicit here, it's worth bringing up again. In the Old Testament, and I think we can learn something from this, like they just don't ever give the devil credit. Just never are like, the devil's really out to get me today. Like, the devil's having his way with me. For them, if you're a monotheist and that God that you worship is sovereign, then the buck stops with him all the time, every time.
I think we tend to kind of slouch into a dualism. Mm-hmm. In order to, as it were, we think that we're saving God in many cases. At least that's the way it strikes me. So
we're trying to defend his reputation. We have this thing of really wanting to keep God clean.
We're the press secretary for God. yes. I think Jonathan Haidt uses that image. So yeah, we're gonna be the press secretary. We're gonna make sure that, you know, whatever has happened, you know, the way the press secretaries are for whoever is in office, they're always going to frame the narrative in such a way that reflects positively upon their boss. Yeah. Well, we can be that way with God too, you know? So you're right. In the Old Testament, it doesn't matter. It always goes back to him. And the buck always stops at the top. So that's the way that Job approaches this.
Yeah.
Then he switches to, I mean, a very common, in the Old Testament, to use animal imagery to kind of metaphorically describe us. So it's what he does in verse 5. Does the wild donkey bray when he has grass, or the ox low in the sense of making like a bellowing noise or whatever sound an ox makes? Do oxes moo? I don't know. Cows do. Oxen. So anyway,
I don't have a lot of experience with the ox. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, me either. Cattle, yes, but not oxen. But anyway, or the ox low over his fodder. What seems to be happening here in verse 5 is, so these animals, if they have grass, if they have food, in other words, if the wild donkey has grass, if the ox has its hay, they're not going to be bellowing. They're not going to be braying, because they got what they need, right?
Yeah.
So they don't make these sounds for no reason. The sounds they make are justified by the absence of what they need. So what Job is saying here is, hey, like the wild donkey, like the ox, so am I. You're not hearing all of these rash words for no reason, because I don't have what I need. And interestingly, in Job's case, what he really wants is God to speak. I mean, he wants a lot of things. He'll complain, I want God to kill me, I just want to die, all this. But really, what he really wants, and you see this more and more as the book progresses, he wants God to see him. He wants God to speak to him. He's wanting some sort of answer from God. And he gets that in the end, of course. Where were you? So he doesn't get necessarily what he bargained for, but he does get that. That's what he's desiring here. But his grass, his fodder, is this divine encounter, which he's not getting. And so for that reason, he's crying out. Plus, of course, what he's suffering.
You know what's weird is that, and I know like we're jumping way ahead, but since you did it, Chad, since you brought it up.
I opened the floodgates.
Since you did that. What's weird is that Job doesn't get the response probably that he's, you know, looking for in the midst of all this. But it's informative because it is enough. When he does get a response, it is enough. And so what it turns out that Job is, I mean, really looking for, I think, is what most people of faith would be looking for in the midst of tremendous suffering. The real question is, has God like completely left? I mean, is he actually just
walked away and left you behind?
Or even worse, is he like completely against me? And even if the word that you end up getting from him is like, hey, just remember, I'm God and you're not. there's mm-hmm. like that's enough in the sense that he has addressed you now.
Yeah, yeah. I would have taken that. Yeah, I mean, a lot of situations in life. I would have just, you know, even that would have been enough. You know, without an answer, you know, not explaining all the details of why this terrible thing happened, but just God saying, listen, I'm not going to explain myself. I'm God and you're not. Well, yeah, at least then you know he's there. He's speaking to you. He's addressing you. He's reminding you of who you are and who he is. And I think, yeah, I would have repented just like Job did.
Yeah.
And shut my lips.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the next verse, I struggled with this one. I think what he's talking about here are the words of his friends. It's not quite clear to me. Maybe he has some insight on this. But verse 6 says, can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in well, this is ESV. I don't even know what this is. In the juice of the mallow, fruit of some sort? I mean, I'm displaying my ignorance here. I don't have any idea what that is. But the older translations have white of an egg. Is any taste in the white of an egg? I think that's what King James and New American Standard has. We really don't know. I mean, if you have a ESV or any note, any Bible with notes, that's going to say the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain because it is. Nobody really knows. A lot of speculation here, but you get the gist of it. Is there any taste in, you know, the juice of something or the white of an egg, whatever it is? The point is that there's nothing there. These things are tasteless. They have to be, something has to be added to them in order for there to be taste. And what seems to be implied by Job is that he's talking about the words of his friends. They're as tasteless, as saltless, as useless as these foods. At least that's the best that I can do with it.
Well, I've always kind of taken these to be kind of what I was talking about before, which is, you know, so can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Imagine this, and this might be incorrect, but can something like this be endured without an explanation? Right. So like maybe you're able to bear up if you have a reason or if you know why. But it seems he's like, listen, there's nothing for me here. Like this is all absent the thing I need to be able to do to undertake this suffering. I don't know. Might be wrong, but that's how I've always kind of read it, is that he's saying, like, I'm just like eating plates full of suffering, but he's talking about food here. So I'm just eating like the most tasteless, terrible things. And God's not giving me so much as like, he's like, hey, you're going to have to eat this. You're going to have to endure this. And you're like, okay. He's not even giving me the seasoning of an explanation of why.
Yeah. No salt, no pepper, no pecani sauce, nothing.
Just take it. Just ingest it. Just swallow this. And you're like, these are not good things. Do you have anything that could make this go down easier? And the answer is no.
It kind of fits with verse 7. My appetite refuses to touch them. They are as food that is loathsome to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what you're serving up, I have no appetite for. In fact, quite the opposite. It's it makes me sick to my stomach to think about.
Yeah.
So that is that's verse 7. Verse 8. Oh, that I might have my request, and that God would fulfill my hope, that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. This would be my comfort. I would even exult in pain unsparing, for I have not denied the words of the Holy One. So what he seems to be doing is basically continuing what he talked about earlier, where his request, his hope, is that God would basically end it. And I've noted before that there's never a desire expressed or a plan expressed that Job would take his own life, but there's plenty in here that he wishes God would take it for him.
Yeah.
Then he would, so that would be his comfort. I would even exult in pain unsparing because I haven't denied the words of the Holy One. So it goes on, verse 11. What is my strength that I should wait? And what is my end that I should be patient? Is my strength the strength of stones? Or is my flesh the flesh of bronze? Have I any help in me when resource is driven from me? So he's like, it's not like I'm not Iron Man here. I'm not bronze man. I'm not a stone man. I'm just a man of flesh and blood. And so there's only so much that my body and my heart and mind are able to take. My help is gone. My resources are gone. And the only thing left for me now is to wish for my own death.
Yeah. I mean, this seems like he's telling God, help me or take me. But this, like, I've come to the end of what I can endure in and of myself.
Yeah, he's out of resources. He's out of, basically out of hope, and so he doesn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. So better just to end it now rather than to go on enduring these arrows of the archer. Now, verse 14, he seems to switch, and I think it's going to continue this through really pretty much through almost the end of the chapter here, where he's going to talk directly to his friends. So he's going to go through an extended comparison of where he's at with regard to his sufferings and needing help and not receiving it in comparison with travelers, guys on a caravan looking for water in the desert. But it begins this way. He says, he who withholds kindness, that's our word chesed, so love and loyalty and all those things. He who withholds chesed from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. So what he's in talking to his friends here, he's saying, you guys are not showing me love. You're not showing me chesed. And in so doing, you're actually forsaking the fear of the Almighty. And what seems to be implied there is that, like, if you fear God, if you're a worshiper of God, if you're a believer in God, all those things are kind of packed into fear. So if that's who you are, you fear God, you believe in him, you worship him, you trust him, then the result of that is you're actually going to show love to a friend, especially one who is going through what I'm going through, and you're going to actually express words of compassion instead of doing what you're doing.
Yeah,
so that's right. Verse 15 says, and this is where he begins kind of this extended metaphor. So he calls them brothers. I don't think this is probably talking about his own family. I think this is talking about Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So the guys who are there, my brothers, are, this is quite the image. They're treacherous as a wadi, a torrent bed. Wadis over Israel are just kind of dry creek beds that only fill when there's rain. So my brothers are treacherous as a wadi. Or a torrent bed, as torrential streams that pass away, which are dark with ice and where the snow hides itself. When they melt, they disappear. When it's hot, they vanish from their place. The caravans turn aside from their course. They go up into the waste and perish. The caravans of Timaluk, the travelers of Shebaluk, they are ashamed because they were confident. They come there and are disappointed. For you, and this is kind of where he transitions to comparing this to his friends, for you have now become nothing. You see my calamity and are afraid. So the whole image behind this is, first of all, you guys have withheld chesed from me, and in so doing have forsaken the fear of the Almighty. And here's what you're like. So just kind of picture Job. He's looking at his friends. He says, you know what, you guys are like, and what I'm like? Well, I'm like a traveler, and I'm thirsty, and I think there's this place where I'm going to get water. I've been there before. I know there's supposed to be water there, and I get there, and there's nothing but sand. There's nothing but rocks. It's all gone. Everything is evaporated. It's dried up. There's nothing there. And of course, when this happens, I'm in a desperate situation because I'm lacking the very thing that I needed. Well, you guys are kind of like that wadi. You're like that torrent bed. You're like that place where I expected to find water, and I didn't. And because of that, all of your words are nothing to me. You have now become nothing, as the ES puts it there. Or maybe the New Revised Standard Version has even better. Such you have now become to me. So this is the kind of the crescendo of this comparison. I looked for water from you. I looked for loving kindness from you. I looked for help from you. And all I got is a mouthful of sand.
Yeah. There's this idea here that, you guys got some like water and stuff, but when the heat gets turned up, so like when conditions are extreme, what that illustrates is that when conditions aren't perfect, you have nothing to offer me, right? So like if conditions are great, yeah, maybe you got water and stuff flowing, but I don't know, in the cold of winter, nope. In the heat of summer, nope. And not only that, but what really is a bummer is that you've come here, and I think there's an accusation here, Chad. I'm interested to know what you think, where he says that you see my calamity and are afraid. I think there's an accusation there that they've not come to help him, but they've come to like investigate to make sure something similar doesn't happen to them. Like, what is it that you did, Job? We got to avoid whatever the heck is going on with Job. Let's make sure we find out what it is so it doesn't happen to us. And so you're not here to help me. You're here because you're afraid of the thing that has happened to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even, just to piggyback on that, they're afraid to become too empathetic with Job, too much kind of part of what he's going through for fear the same thing's going to happen to them, you know? And
if God is judging, if God's judging you, like, I don't want to help you too much. I mean, I don't want to try to alleviate the judgment of God if that is indeed what's happening.
I mean, yeah, this stuff happens all the time still today. I mean, we know the temptation. There is a temptation when you see even somebody that maybe is a close friend who's just going through a terrible, terrible situation, like even to distance yourself. Mm-hmm. People, I mean, that's a very real temptation for whatever. I mean, maybe it's because, I mean, I just don't have the emotional bandwidth to become involved in this situation, you know? Or maybe we're just afraid because we don't have all the answers. We're afraid to get involved with that. We don't know what to say. Or, yeah, we might look at that and be like, oh, my gosh, that guy must have angered God. Look what's happening to him. I don't want to get too close to him. You know, lightning might strike me, too. I think all of those are, I'm not saying they're legitimate fears, but they're very common fears that people have when they see somebody who is really, really going through suffering.
Yeah. And I think that's why he says, yeah, you didn't come here with love and kindness. You came here out of fear because you want to know what's going on.
Yeah, so he says, verse 22 and 23, he's basically saying in these verses, look, I didn't ask you for a gift or for, deliverance or anything like that. He says, have I said, make me a gift? Or from your wealth, offer a bribe for me, or deliver me from the adversary's hand, or redeem me from the hand of the ruthless. I didn't ask you for any of that. I didn't ask you to come and like, you know, bail me out or to rescue me from someone who has abducted me. I didn't ask you for any of that. You came here of your own accord to be my comforters, and I haven't asked anything from you. But what you are doing is demanding from me an explanation as to why I'm suffering the way I am. And I don't know. I don't know why God has set me up as his target. Then he continues, and this is some of this is pretty heavily sarcastic. Teach me, he says. That's the root of Torah, by the way. Yara is the word to teach here. So teach me. I mean, give me some instruction here. I'll be your student, right? I'll be silent. You can teach me. You can just shed all of your wisdom on me. Make me understand how I've gone astray. How forceful are upright words, but what does reproof from you reprove? In other words, what are you accomplishing? What are you really accomplishing by your insinuations with regard to my hidden sin? Do you think you can reprove words when the speech of a despairing man is wind? And this, verse 27, and we're almost to the end of this chapter. Verse 27 is where he really kind of throws it in their face. And I don't know that this is a very fair accusation. I'm going to attribute it simply to Job being in a very, very bad place. Because to his friends, he says, you know what kind of guys you are? I'll tell you, you're the kind of guys who would cast lots over an orphan. and you would bargain over a friend. Or as the NET translation puts it, yes, you would gamble for the fatherless and auction off your friend. So that's a pretty in your face accusation to make to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. Deserved or not, you can kind of understand Job is already put out with them. And if he's already put out with them, keep in mind, only Eliphaz has spoken so far. The other guys have not spoken yet, but he's upset with all three of them at this point.
It seems that Job knows that he is a better man than them. And it also seems like Job knows that they know that he is a better man than him. And so he is very much being like, oh, all right. So you're here out of fear, and maybe this is part of it. They're like, dude, this could happen to Job. Good grief. He's the most righteous dude around. And he's like, all right, man. I don't know what's going on. So, yeah, teach me, oh righteous ones. We all know how good you guys are. Like, teach me. I'll be silent. And, yeah, just bring, give me those forceful, upright words. Like, let's do that. Yeah, and then it says, you would do this. Like, you would cast lots over the fatherless and this kind of thing. There does seem to be listen, can we stop pretending like I'm some kind of bigger sinner than you guys when everyone here knows that's not true? I'm not a worse person than you, so knock it off.
Yeah, I think that's where he's going with this.
What are you going to teach me, dude? What are you going to teach me, really?
Fill me with your wisdom. All right, so we got three verses left, and that'll be the end of chapter 6, and that'll be the end of our time. So he says, but now be pleased to look at me, for I will not lie to your face. Please turn. Let no injustice be done. Turn now. My vindication is at stake. Is there any injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern the cause of calamity? So look at me. I'm not going to lie to you. Just turn to me. Let me know. Is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern the cause of calamity? I think what he's saying here is that, I can figure these things out. I can taste the truth, in other words. And what I'm tasting here is that everything is bitter to me and I can't find the cause. I don't know what it is. And you're of no help, because all you've done so far is insinuate that the problem lies with me. And I'm telling you, it does not. So that's where he wraps up the chapter. And then that's not the end of his speech, chapter 7. We only got through one chapter today. But chapter 7, he's going to continue with his description of the struggle that we face in this life. He's going to compare our life here. It sounds like Koheleth of Ecclesiastes, honestly. Like, vanity of vanities is the way that chapter 7 begins to feel. But then he's going to shift to more of a direct address to God in the verses that follow.
Yeah, these last verses almost make it sound like as they're with him and as these statements are being made, that they're not, it's almost like they can't make eye contact with him. They can't bear to look at him. I mean, he probably is horrific to view. And he does this thing like, hey, look at me. Take a good hard look at me and then tell me that what I'm saying is unjust. Like, you tell me, if any of my words, is there any injustice on my tongue, right? Like, you guys aren't looking at me. Look at what's going on here, and then be honest. You guys tell me, am I wrong for has anything I've said been inappropriate? But I need you to take a good hard look at me first. Audit this situation, and then you tell me if I'm, out of order for being upset here. And that's what it seems like. But I'm going to need you to look.
Right. Quit turning your gaze away to more desirable objects and look at my ugly situation, and let's talk truth to each other.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, that is the end of that chapter. We will be back next week to discuss how Job continues. It's all very depressing so far, but we're getting to some classic lines of hope eventually. But we're going to have to take the long journey there. I will see you next week, Chad.
See you then.